Salve podcast listeners, just a quick notice. In our last episode of Emperors of Rome, we talked about Trajan going and conquering Dacia. Now, to commemorate that victory, he had a massive monument built called Trajan's Column. So if you'd like to know more about the column, the construction of it, and what it all means, then go and listen to the new episode of the When in Rome podcast. Rhiannon and I have discussed it over there. Now, coming up, there's a bit of a long episode, so maybe pause it, go and make yourself a hot drink, and enjoy. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me, as always, is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XLVII, Pliny the Younger. Now, in our discussions on Trajan, we're a bit short on sources, but one of the most important things we do have is the correspondence between Trajan as an emperor and a man named Pliny the Younger, someone who he was quite close with, he was a governor at the time, and also a respected writer and thinker in the 2nd century CE. So we thought while we look at this correspondence, we'll take a look at the rest of Pliny's career and the collected letters that he sent. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Pliny was born during the reign of Nero in either late 61 or early 62 CE. And he's from northern Italy, from Comum, which is now Como, on Lago di Como, which is very beautiful. You ever been there?
No, I haven't.
It's very close to Switzerland and it's a gorgeous lake. So he was born in a part of Italy, which by this point, it doesn't matter so much which part of Italy you come from. But it's not in Rome itself. He's not at the center of power growing up. And he's not from a senatorial family. He's from the next level down from an equestrian family. But that too is becoming less and less important by this point.
It's probably important to say at this point that his name from birth isn't Pliny, is it?
It's not. No, that's a name that he takes upon adoption. But it's a name that's part of his mother's name because he, of course, would take his father's name. So his name would have been Caecilius originally. His father's name was Gaius Caecilius, and that was his name too. But his mother's name, his mother's family is Plinius, and he gets that name when he's adopted by his uncle, probably when his uncle died. He was adopted in his will. So then he gets the very long name of Gaius. He keeps that. Gaius Plinius, Luci Filius, which is son of Lucius, Caecilius Secundus.
Right.
It's a big long one to sign your name to.
Which is why we just call him Pliny the Younger.
Yes.
Yes.
Indeed. So he's the nephew of Pliny the Elder, and Pliny the Elder is the one who adopts him.
So when Pliny is young, what sort of upbringing does he have? What do we know about his family and his early life?
He's brought up initially by his mother. There is a theory that his parents were actually separated. And that's based on an inscription that's been found, which seems to leave some of his father's wealth to a concubine.
Oh.
But there's no other evidence outside of that.
Early Roman days of our lives.
It doesn't necessarily mean that they were separated or divorced, but it may mean that. When his father died, when he was quite young, he becomes a kind of foster child to a Roman military commander who's called Virginius, who was consul in 63. So he's already in close contact with the right kind of people. His family have the networks to the center of power. And indeed, that's true of his uncle too, whose work is dedicated to the Emperor Titus. So he's not low down in the Roman hierarchies. He's got the right family connections. He's educated in the way traditionally Roman boys would be. He's educated in rhetoric, and that shows in the writings that we have of his. He's sent to Rome at some point, where one of his educators is someone who writes a work on rhetoric, as Quintilian, who wrote 10 books on how to write good speeches, basically, how to give good speeches and be an orator. So he's had training by the best.
And really trying to emulate these people then, I guess. So was he writing from an early age?
We know that he had some kind of adventures in literature, that he wrote some poetry and wrote in Greek and played around with drama as well. The one or two bits that we have of that is not highly regarded, the bits and pieces he quotes. What we have of his is remaining from later in his life, and it's mostly in prose in his letters.
So his uncle, Pliny the Elder, deserves a podcast or two by himself at some point. But let's just quickly cover his part of the story in relation to Pliny the Younger. So he's a well-respected scholar in Rome, isn't he? A well-respected historian, a naturalist. He's been called the Leonardo da Vinci of his day, which is possibly a bit of a reach. But what sort of person and what sort of influence was Pliny the Elder on the younger Pliny?
Well, he's somebody who's always writing, always having a scribe at hand to write down what he's doing, because he's most famous for the work that survives, his Natural History, this big encyclopedia of everything that is natural and in some cases unnatural in the world. That means he's kind of constantly curious. This probably had an influence on Pliny too. Certainly his letters do a bit of that. It's a sort of an observational stance that he takes in some ways. But Pliny the Younger didn't necessarily do the same kind of scientific writing, although some people wouldn't regard Pliny the Elder's work as particularly scientific these days.
But contemporary, it was. It was the benchmark of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And it collects an awful lot of information. So as collectors of information, I suppose they stand side by side.
So when Pliny the Elder passes away, younger Pliny is 18, and he later wrote an account about the event, which is probably the best account that we have on the eruption of Vesuvius, isn't it? And the destruction of Pompeii.
Yes, indeed. It's one of the few accounts we have of somebody who was there or who was in the region. Although Pliny the Younger was sent away. He was sent away to Misenum, away from the danger. He could still see the bay when it was clear that this was a dangerous event, but typically Pliny the Elder stayed to observe. So he can give an account of what is happening when the volcano erupts. He's actually giving the account to someone we know well, which is Tacitus. So he writes two letters to Tacitus to tell him what happened when Vesuvius erupted. He's telling him what happened to his uncle. So he clearly thinks his uncle is going to be an important player in terms of Tacitus writing about that event. And Tacitus wants an eyewitness account. We don't know whether Tacitus made use of that, unfortunately, because that bit of the histories is missing. So that may have turned up. It would be great to have those two pieces of work side by side, Pliny's letter and what Tacitus did with it, because Pliny explicitly says at the end, oh, you know, I'm writing from this account of what happened to my uncle. Obviously, you will make use of whatever details you want.
Mm-hmm. Kind of interesting insight into how Tacitus was possibly doing research at the time.
Yeah, indeed, that he's getting a direct account. I have to say, people are often unkind about Pliny, and they tend to think that in this letter, Pliny's very happy with the fact that Tacitus wants information from him, you know, this great man, this great historian, and he wants to mine my brain to get something out of this. You could read the letter like that, but it's, you know, two peers, two contemporaries sharing information.
Can you read some of it out?
Elder Pliny Death. This is the one we want. For anyone who wants to look this up, Pliny's letters are divided up into 10 books, and this is book 6, letter 16 to Cornelius Tacitus, and is one of the longer letters, as you might expect, a fairly lengthy description. And he gives us at various points in the letter an actual description of what he could see going on. He says at first all he saw was a cloud. This is, he says, on the 24th of August, 79 CE. Its general appearance can be expressed like an umbrella pine. It's a very famous description of the cloud, for it rose to a great height on a sort of trunk and then split into two branches, I imagine, because it was thrust upwards by the first blast and left unsupported as the pressure subsided, or else it was borne by its own weight so that it spread out and gradually dispersed. I think there you can see a little bit of the influence of the elder Pliny, the trying to explain scientifically what was going on with the volcano. And a little bit later in the letter, then he talks a little bit about what he and his mother did and how his uncle was very interested in writing all of this down. So he tells scribes to come and make notes and tries to get a boat to get closer to it. Meanwhile, on Mount Vesuvius, broad sheets of fire and leaping flames blazed at several points, their bright glare emphasized by the darkness of night. Then he talks about how the elder Pliny tries to calm everyone down because they're all very scared, and his uncle is trying to allay their fears, he says. And towards the end of the letter, he says, outside, that they're inside by this point to be safer, as they think, there was the danger of falling pumice stones, which is quite dangerous, stones falling on your head, even though these were light and porous. And also, it just goes black. They go through the night and they come to daylight. They were still in darkness, blacker and denser than any ordinary night, he says. Mm. And at that point, he never sees his uncle again. He's been sent away. And
Yeah. So they're watching this from Naples-ish. Pliny the Elder takes the fleet that he's got under his command there, goes to Pompeii to rescue and observe and get a closer look, people from Pompeii, and is never heard from again.
He clearly is... His constitution is not strong enough to take all of the
ash and the
all
smoke.
All of the ash that's in the air.
Yeah.
He suffocates almost certainly, and his body is found a few days later completely intact. He hasn't been hit by the stones or affected by the lava. But as Pliny says, he's still fully clothed and looking more like sleep than death.
Ah, okay. I have an interesting fact. Volcanologists refer to that sort of eruption as a Plinian eruption. Thanks to this description that he came up with.
He'd be proud.
He would be. And his uncle may be just a little bit jealous.
Yeah, although I guess that his uncle's presence there was significant. Oh, it may have been maybe shared between the two Plinys. I like the little detail that he gives at the end, which is quite affecting, that it's more like he's asleep. We do get that occasionally from Pliny. You get these very clear marks of affection, closeness to certain people. It's one of the things that's great to read his letters for.
So Pliny the Elder leaves his estate, his belongings to Pliny the Younger, and also in the same document adopts him, hence Pliny the Younger taking on the name Pliny. At that point, he gets access to a lot of money, a lot of property, and I suppose a great library as well, doesn't he?
He would have got a great library out of it. He has vast wealth.
Yeah.
I mean, the kind of wealth that we could only dream of, I think. And there's actually an interesting letter in which he describes his villa, not in northern Italy, but much closer to Rome.
Just one of his villas.
His Laurentian villa. Oh, yes, there were several homes, and that would have been quite normal for the Roman elite. But I particularly like some of this letter.
Wait, what's the reference?
Okay. I'm glad that you want references.
Yeah, yep.
If only all students were so zealous. Is Book 2, Letter 17. It's a famous letter because it's one of those few descriptions of an elite villa that we have. And I won't read it all because, again, it's one of the longer ones. But
wait, who's this one to?
This is to someone called Gallus. We don't necessarily know who all of the recipients are. There are a wide range of them. It's a letter that, you know, we often use to try and reconstruct villas or judge the remains of villas against it. And if you have the Penguin edition, then there's a little plan of it in the back, an attempt to reconstruct it from his description, because it is a very kind of practical description. But he starts it off by saying that, or at least in about paragraph 2, he says, it's a house that's large enough for my needs, but not expensive at all. It's quite modest in terms of the upkeep. And then I won't read it all, but I'll tell you that he says it opens into a hall, unpretentious, but not without dignity. Then there are two colonnades. He describes it in detail, and it empties into an enclosed courtyard. Opposite the middle of this, there's a cheerful inner hall and then a dining room, which is really rather fine, he says. Then he goes on, he describes that in a lot of detail. Dining rooms are important. Then there's a little farther back from the sea, because this is a seaside villa, by the way, is a large bedroom, and then a smaller one, which lets in the morning sunshine. And there's a view of the sea from this as well. And he talks about how, you know, in some of the rooms, when the waves are large, you can see the sea spume on the window. So it's that close to the sea. It's direct beach access. This is my favourite part. This is an unpretentious house, remember. He's got the winter quarters and the gymnasium of my house.
All right.
Which is in a protected quarter of the house. No winds can be heard there, so that's important, apparently. And then we go around the corner, and there's a little apse to let in the sun in a room that's very, very important, which is a library, basically, a room fitted out with shelves to hold the books, which I read again and again. So not all of his books, but just the ones he likes to read quite frequently. Next comes a bedroom, because we've only had two so far, and then a floor fitted with the pipes, which you'd need for the hypocaust, basically.
Mm, that's the heating.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. So he's got, obviously, he's got all the mod cons in terms of household heating.
Mm.
And then the remaining rooms on this side of the house are for the slaves and freedmen. But most of them are quite presentable enough for guests.
So okay.
Goodness knows how many bedrooms there. He doesn't bother to delineate because it's just for the slaves and ex-slaves.
Yeah. But it's kind of interesting that this is, you know, the way he's describing it, it sounds very elaborate to us. But he's describing it as, you know, it's quite a modest villa. It's suitable for my needs.
Yeah.
Compared to the other ones out there, it's maybe slumming it a bit.
By the way, I haven't finished.
There are about another 10 rooms.
In fact, we probably don't have time to do them all.
But
there are more bedrooms, more dining rooms, restrooms, a bath and a kitchen garden and some little sort of houses that people live in on the estate.
So,
not bad lifestyle just for one of your houses. And he would have had a house at Rome. Obviously, he would have had property up at Comum and goodness knows where else. Pliny has plenty of money.
Plus, career-wise, he moved around, didn't he?
He did. He goes through the career path that you might expect of a Roman of his status. Early on, he's got some fairly minor roles, minor magistracies at Rome. At one point, he's made the finance officer for the military in Syria. He's obviously not a military officer. He's very much in administrative posts and very often in finance posts, which seems to be his strength. In 88 CE, he becomes a quaestor. So he's on that career path now of the kind of Roman who could get to be consul, could get the top magistracy. And he's a quaestor who has a job where he has to work with the emperor's staff. And the emperor at this point is Domitian. So he's sort of one of the people who's channeling communication to Domitian. 3 years later, he's tribune of the plebs in 91. And in 93, he's praetor, which is a year earlier than would have been expected. So he's making his way through the career path and he's actually doing fine in those very dangerous years of Domitian in the 90s.
Yeah. His career survives beyond that. So he's clearly competent enough or not dangerous enough to still be able to continue in administrative capacity. But we've got really detailed records of his career. And this is one of the best records that we have for a kind of administrative career in the Roman Empire at this time. So where are we getting all these from? They're from his letters, aren't they?
Yes, it's mostly him kind of reflecting back on his career. A lot of the time, he's actually reflecting back on bad things that happened during Domitian's reign, because he's sort of in a similar position to Tacitus in that he survived, utterly condemns Domitian afterwards, and condemns the people who he sees as Domitian's cronies.
But he did flourish under Domitian's rule.
Absolutely, he did. And one of his fellow praetors didn't. A man called Arrhenius Senecio is executed for treason. And that's kind of the beginning of Domitian's reign of terror. But Pliny survives and he gets another treasury post after that, right at the end of Domitian's reign. Which is not to say that he's complicit in the terrible things that are happening, but most people will read his letters as attempts to show that he was on the side of those who lost out, that he was just lucky to survive, I guess. So he often talks about people who were executed or their family members, how heroic they were to a certain extent, that he's got contacts with family members who've survived or the granddaughter of one particularly martyr-filled family he talks about in some of his letters. He's probably trying to associate himself with the martyrhood of those people. We've talked in the past, I think, about the Stoic opposition from the time of about Nero onwards.
Yeah.
We've got figures like Thrasea Paetus and indeed Caecilius Paetus who are executed, Caecilius by Nero and then Thrasea later on. And he is associating himself with the granddaughter of one of the women in those families, a woman called Arria. He says he's had correspondence from her. And he talks at great length about this woman, Arria. Now, Arria was most famous for committing suicide with her husband. her husband had been told that he had to kill himself. He was apparently hesitating. And she took the dagger from him and thrust it into her breast and said, "It doesn't hurt, Paetus." And this became, you know, you could just say those words and they were meaningful. That was the ultimate heroic womanhood.
Yeah.
She wasn't condemned to death. She could have lived on.
But she set the example.
Yeah. Pliny knows that this is almost a cliche. He writes this letter saying, "I've been chatting to her granddaughter and there are these other anecdotes about her which show that she was equally heroic all the way along, you know, and she was brave and she was determined to die with him. It wasn't just something she decided flippantly. All the way along, she'd been deciding that and she did all these other heroic things." Like he gives a little anecdote about how when their son died, she kept this from her husband, who was also ill with the same illness, and she pretended that he was fine, which I'm not sure we would necessarily consider heroic now. But to Pliny, this is something very noble to do, that she puts on this face in front of her husband who's unwell. So he's very keen to associate himself with them. And he also gives us these stories, for one thing, which often involve women. We don't always hear a lot about from other male authors, and talk about these outstanding people, but also talk about ordinary life.
Yeah.
So it's a great mix of all of that.
What do these letters tell us about Pliny's personal life? Were there any love letters for Pliny?
Not what we would call love letters, but he does have letters occasionally to and more about his wife. He's married three times, and the letters that we have are concerning his third wife. The one that I had to study as an undergraduate, and we were almost entirely a room full of girls, enjoying this letter greatly, because this is probably an older man with a younger wife, given that she is the third wife. And it's written to the person who took care of his wife before she was married, saying how brilliant she is to have nurtured this young woman who's so lovely and loves him so much.
So firstly, who is his wife?
His wife is called Calpurnia.
Yeah.
And this is to a woman called Calpurnia Hispula.
And the letter reference is?
It's book 4, letter 19. Then it basically goes on to describe what's so wonderful about his wife. This is clearly very early in the marriage. She's highly intelligent and a careful housewife. You know, we should all aspire to this. Her devotion to me is a sure indication of her virtue. In addition, this love has given her an interest in literature. So being married to me has made her be interested in letters, words. She keeps copies of my works to read again and again, and even to learn by heart. She's so anxious when she knows I'm going to plead in court, and so happy when it's over. And then a little bit later, if I'm giving a reading, she sits behind a curtain nearby and greedily drinks in every word of appreciation.
Wow.
That's my favourite bit. She can't be out there in public, but she wants to be there anyway. And look, we mocked this mercilessly as you know, callow 19-year-olds who are very cynical. The best bit, however, I've forgotten to read. She has even set my verses to music and sings them to the accompaniment of her lyre.
Wow.
But I have to say, coming back to this as an older person, the second paragraph of the letter, it is actually quite nice and affectionate.
It does sound like he's really quite fond of her.
Yeah, yeah. But I think we thought at the time that she's just putting it on to keep him happy.
Yeah, but it did. It kept him happy.
He says, and this I think is quite sweet, "All this gives me the highest reason to hope that our mutual happiness will last forever and going increasing day by day. For she does not love me for my present age, nor my person, which will gradually grow old and decay, but for my aspirations to fame." Oh yes, Pliny. And then he goes on to say, of course, that's exactly what you'd expect of someone brought up by you, the person he's writing the letter to. And ends it with, "Please accept our united thanks for having given her to me, and me to her, as if chosen for each other." So I have to say, we've only got his side of it, but it does make it look like a marriage of mutual love, which was the Roman ideal, but was not always attained. And we know of cases where it certainly wasn't attained in the imperial family. You know, maybe Pliny was quite a pleasant person to live with, and I'm sure that lovely villa would have
made it quite easy.
Yeah, yeah. Been handy.
While he flourished during Domitian, the greatest association he has with an emperor is his relationship with Trajan, which is why we're timing this podcast for now. He wrote something which you talked about in a previous Trajan podcast, something that was laying it on a bit thick, wasn't he?
Well, It is called the Panegyricus or the Panegyric, so you might expect that it is the ultimate praise of Trajan. And it's a speech he gives in the year 100 CE, which is the year that Pliny is consul. So he does reach his highest magistracy in the reign of Trajan. It's a speech that, in a way, some people would argue is as much about Domitian as it is about Trajan, because it's all about how brilliant Trajan is compared to how terrible Domitian was in some ways. So, you know, he talks about the freedoms we have now. We have our dignity as senators. We don't have to bow and scrape. In other words, we did have to do all of that under Domitian. We never knew what was going to happen next. So it's sort of about the security and the sure footing that he feels that the Senate has now with Trajan. You could always make the argument, by the way, with these kind of speeches or writings, that they're an attempt to get the emperor to act in that way. This is 2 years into Trajan's reign. You could say it's still relatively early on. And if you lay on the praise enough, then Trajan will think, this is a good way to behave. I'll do that. I don't know whether any emperor or any body is as simple to read as that and to influence as that would suggest. But it is a great speech, and it is an important speech. You know, Pliny had been trained in rhetoric and was very good at it. And it's the first public speech that we have extant since the time of Cicero.
Right, yeah.
So that's a big gap. I mean, Cicero died in 43 BCE. So this is nearly 150 years later. One of the reasons it survives is that it was considered rhetorically very good. So it was taught. It was used to teach boys how to write good speeches.
Yeah, okay. Well done, Pliny. The other record that we've got of his ten books of his letters. Now, the first nine he prepared and edited himself for publication, didn't he? He said, these are good letters. This is worth putting out there for the people to read. But the 10th one is just raw accounts.
It is.
It's letters back and forth between him and Trajan. And he didn't intend for that to be published.
Apparently not. I mean, maybe he would have done if he had lived, if he'd have polished them up. He says in the first letter of book one that these are the letters that I've polished up. They're not in chronological order. I've even put them into, you know, I've thought about the way that they're going to be framed and which one will come next to have variety. So he doesn't have the chance to do that with book 10. It's as it comes. But obviously it's very, very important, because it's not only a record of Pliny as he's now a governor in Bithynia and Pontus in the east. So it's a record of his time there as a governor. But there are letters from Trajan. So we have letters from an emperor, which is unique. And we have quite a few of them. A lot of them are quite curt, it has to be said, on Trajan's part. But nevertheless, it's a record of Pliny's time there and the responses that he is getting from the emperor himself.
I mean, look, I can understand the curtness because, you know, he's a busy man. He's got Dacians to fight. Firstly, we'll kind of wade into what problems was Pliny dealing with, and were they representative of the kind of problems that a governor of a province was dealing with?
Trajan's not dealing with Dacians by this point, by the way.
Okay, sorry.
It's in 110.
Okay, all right.
he's finished with the Dacians by then.
Okay.
Yeah, Pliny he's technically called the Legatus Augusti, the legate of Augustus there. One of the reasons that historians like to look at Book 10 is that it does exactly that. It shows us what the day-to-day business of a governor, at least in an analogous province, might have been doing. And a lot of it is, especially at the start, they haven't been managing their finances very well. He's obsessed with finances. You know, they've been overspending on this bath building that they're putting up. What do you think I should do about this? Obviously, I'm going to have to curtail it. So he's kind of talking about reducing public spending and making sure there's not corruption going on. So he's getting involved in the nitty-gritty of what they're doing within particular towns in these provinces and what's been going wrong. He looks like he's been sent there to fix things.
Yeah.
Actually, the bath building is one of the letters that I particularly like Trajan's response to. It's book 10, these are all book 10, letter 39 and 40. Pliny talks about a couple of different things, a theatre at Nicaea, which is half built, and do they really have the money to finish it? And then a public bath at a place called Claudiopolis, obviously named after Claudius. It's very, very grand, and they're building it in the hollow of a mountain. And I think there's been a misapplication of funds, he says. so I need to find out from you what I should do. Trajan answers, those poor Greeks all love a gymnasium. He's really condescending. So it may be that they were too ambitious with their plan, he says. They'll have to be content with one that suits their real needs. So let's just cut through to it. That literally is Trajan's answer.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all of it to at least that bit of the letter. And then he says, as for the bath of Claudiopolis, you say it's been started in an unsuitable place. You must decide yourself what advice to give. So number one, draw it back. Yes, you're right. Number two, it's your decision. Get on with it, Pliny.
Yeah, and you said this is like letter 39 and 40?
Yeah.
We're all governors writing to Trajan with this much kind of trivial kind of matters?
Well, this is an issue, isn't it? Is it trivial? The counter argument to that is that we've got 61 letters.
Yeah.
Written over a number of years.
Okay, yeah.
So, and most of the ones we've got are in the first year of him being there. So he's sort of getting settled in, finding out what are the edges of his power, I suppose. How much does he have to ask Trajan? And it may well be that after this point, after getting the you have to decide what to do, Pliny,
yeah,
he starts to realise what his responsibilities are and cuts back on what he needs to ask. Yeah, I mean, that is very much what people have said about Pliny, that he's too needy. He needs to ask everything. And Trajan just says, I'm tired of hearing from you. But that's very much reading between the lines.
Yeah.
And, you know, if Pliny had gone ahead and made those decisions, who knows? And I think it's Betty Radice who writes in The Penguin, says, who knows what decisions Pliny made that he didn't write letters about? We've only got the ones he did write letters about. And he asks about some things that are quite important, legal issues and that kind of thing, which Trajan might have actually cared about. He might have wanted his decision to be made there because, after all, his official title is the legate of Augustus. He's standing in for him.
Mm.
So he needs to know what Trajan wants to happen.
The other thing that is well known about the letters of Pliny is that it's got a documented mention of Christians. It mightn't have been a big deal in the contemporary context of when he wrote it, but in the years that have followed, it has since become a quite notable letter, hasn't it? And we discussed this in an entire Romans versus Christians podcast.
We did.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, as an addendum to that, we could say the fact that Pliny bothers to write might make it slightly more important than if he'd just made the decision himself. So I'm backtracking a bit on what I said in that previous podcast. But yeah, you're quite right that this is one of the few places we hear about the Christians and the Romans' responses to Christianity. Basically, it's a long letter from Pliny and a shorter one from Trajan, as usual. So it's letters 96 and 97 in book 10. And Pliny is very, very careful. He has had legal training to describe exactly what he does. He starts off with a bit of flattery of Trajan. I need your help. You need to inform my ignorance, he actually says. What he wants to know is not, is it right to punish these people, but am I doing it in the right way?
Okay, yeah.
This is very definitely what we would call persecution, but Pliny doesn't regard it as that. And he wants to know specifically, does it make a difference if they're women or if they're young? Do they need to be punished in a different way or given more options to recant? Can we pardon these people if they've ever practiced Christianity or professed Christianity before? And is it just being called a Christian that's punishable, or do you have to actually carry out acts? Which is sort of, Pliny doesn't know it, but it gets to some of the questions that have gone through religion through the years. Can you just be called a member of a religion, or do you have to do things?
Do you have to be practicing, yeah.
To be part of that. He refers to it as a stubbornness, that people won't give this up, that they've got unshakable obstinacy, he says. And that's what he's annoyed by. He doesn't really go into detail about what Christians do that he feels is wrong. He just says their obstinacy and not giving it up is what should be punished, which is interesting. And when he describes what they do, it's even in a positive light. All they did was they gathered together and certain things they promised not to do, like commit adultery or steal things. which, you know, even Pliny can't disagree with, really. But the vital thing is, he says, a lot of them have given it up, actually, since I put into practice something that you mandated, which is that secret societies should not meet.
Okay.
And yeah. he uses a particular word, which we don't really find many other places, which is the word hetaeria, which means a political society or a secret society. That's the problem.
Yeah.
I think that's at the heart of it for the Romans. It's the meeting up together and you don't know what's going on.
So what's Trajan's response to that?
Well, Trajan's response is not as short as some of his letters, but...
Deal with it?
Well, he says, no, this is a little more a little more pleasant to Pliny. You've followed the right course, right? You're doing the right procedure. My dear Pliny, he does express some kind of closeness with Pliny at times. But he says it's impossible to have fixed rules. So you've got to deal with it on a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
So if the charge against them's proved, they've got to be punished. And this is important information for us historically, I suppose. But if there's somebody who says they're not a Christian and proves it by making prayers to our gods, then yes, they can be pardoned. So what they have to do is go through some ritual, some pagan rituals, and that lets them off the hook. And then he ends it, and this is interesting because it addresses the secret society part of this. Anonymously circulated pamphlets must play no part in the accusation. So you mustn't just take evidence of hearsay.
All right, so don't act on bad mouthing. No. You need evidence
exactly.
before you.
He says that's a bad precedent.
Well, yeah. Yeah, good call on that.
Yeah. So, you know, Trajan's fairly balanced on all of this. And I've said he's curt, but he always kind of, he does answer the question, which is not always the case when you write emails to people and ask a question, is
no,
it?
No, very true. Yes. Something that I get from that is definitely mutual respect. Pliny seemed to be quite close with Trajan.
I think there is mutual respect. And it's very clear who has the authority. Mm. And Pliny respects that authority. And Trajan is, while you might not say happy to give the answers, he does respond. And I guess something we all think when we get responses from people high up is, oh, it could just be one of his officials who's been delegated to this, which is possible and does kind of undermine the idea that we are getting direct responses from an emperor. But Pliny is a governor and it would be quite appropriate for the emperor himself to respond directly.
So what do we know about the end of Pliny's life? We don't know when he died exactly, do we?
We don't. And this is the case for an awful lot of ancient authors and figures. What we usually have to do is we look to see what's the last event that we can reference in their writings. And there's nothing later than 113 CE in Pliny's letters. So we assume that he died that year.
Probably quite a safe thing to assume because Book 10 was published after he died and what that was referring to and everything.
It is, although, as I say, the letters may have been petering out a little bit as he got more confident in his role. But if he'd returned from Bithynia, we'd expect there'd be letters telling us about that, and there aren't. So he died in Bithynia, we can assume.
But as far as an account of this time period in Rome, in absence of an actual historical record along the lines of Tacitus or Suetonius, these letters are really important to what we know about Rome, isn't it?
They're a great resource in terms of their variety, which is one of the things Pliny prides himself on, that he can provide such a variety of different letter types and recipients indeed. And they give us a good picture of somebody at that level of society operating within Rome at this point when, you know, you've still got aspirations to certain roles and he acts as a mentor to lots of other figures and he's very pleased about that, about the benevolence that he can have towards other individuals and also whole peoples because he's got so much money. And, you know, it's quite interesting to read Pliny and see that him trying to be modest but trying to show you how good he is at the same time. He sort of sees his place in society very clearly, I think. He knows that he's beneath the emperor, but he also knows that he has a responsibility to other people. So it gives us all of these insights into what was going on in the life and the responsibilities of someone of Pliny's kind.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Please leave a review there and tell your friends about it. Hello in particular to all our Italian listeners. Our podcast is now charting in the podcast store in Italy, so I hope we're doing your history justice.
If you like this podcast, you can come and find us on Facebook. Feel free to come by and tell us what you think about Pliny the Younger and his texts. And you can follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we'll look at the rest of Trajan's time as an emperor and what he did to deserve the title Optimus Princeps. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.